Welcome to this edition of Middle Market Musings, the podcast devoted to the people and ideas of the middle market. I'm Andy Greenberg of Greenberg Variations Capital.
And I'm Charlie Gifford of New Heritage Capital. Today we are speaking with Jay Weinstein, Vice Chair of Growth at Eisner Amper, a leading accounting and advisory firm. Before we start, Andy and I would like to thank our two main sponsors, New Heritage Capital and Greenberg Variations Capital, as well as our media partner, PE Professional Digest. We wouldn't be anywhere without their support. We hope you enjoy today's episode of Middle Market Musings.
Lay me my money down.
Jay Weinstein, welcome to Middle Market Musings.
Thank you, Andy.
We're delighted to have you here for this possibly career-changing event of talking with Charlie and me. Before, you know, there's a lot for us to unpack getting to the activities today of Eisner Amper.
It's just kind of what you say when you hit rock bottom, Andy. It's a career-changing event, so that maybe I can only go up from here. Is that the idea?
That's possible. But why don't we start at the beginning? As you know, a Philly guy, grew up in the Olney section, Philadelphia, went to Central High School. The big thing for people here in Philadelphia. What pointed you in the direction of being in the leadership of a large accounting and advisory firm?
Yeah, you've known me a long time. I've always sort of gravitated towards accounting, not intentionally, but just something I always liked, even starting in elementary school. I was a treasurer, and then I always seemed to be the person watching the money. So I had this thing about being honest, that this weird sort of concept of watching other people's money as if it were my own. And I've always, that's sort of been a thread throughout my career. Clients have always said, you know, you care about my finances as much as I do. And it wasn't necessarily intentional. It's just sort of the way that it should be.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that was like a huge turn on for girls and like in middle school. So I have to ask you that, in addition to your accounting acumen, did the young Jay Weinstein, did you have game?
I put this way, I don't remember much of fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh grade, as I was distracted. So, it's amazing I graduated from even from grade school. I happened to go away this weekend with two old friends from elementary school, and we were musing about lost opportunity because we were distracted all the time. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of insight.
So I want to understand a little bit, Jay, about a treasurer. I'm thinking about a treasurer in grade school, and I'm thinking about the guy that holds all the dues money from like the Cub Scouts. Or what are we talking about here?
Charlie's a really big responsibility.
Oh, sure, man.
I required our elementary school to get me D&O insurance. I mean, it was a big deal.
To Andy's point, you must have been quite the heartthrob at the junior high dance, talking to lady about debits and credits and stuff. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
They lined up.
I love it.
I've never actually seen you play basketball, but I know through mutual friends that you love the game and have a view of your own abilities that is generous. At what age did that start?
I make up for a complete lack of any ability or skill by being the dirtiest player you ever play against. So I'll tell you a quick story. My older son was, when he was in college, went to a weekend social thing at Penn. And one of the other people there asked, what's your name? So he told him his name. He said, your father's on Jay Weinstein, is he? Oh, he said, yeah. I played in a basketball tournament against him, and he tripped me. He elbowed me, and I left that tournament completely black and blue. So my reputation around being a dirty basketball player precedes me. We also actually run a private equity basketball tournament every summer down at the Plesha. We get about 25 private equity funds. And the interesting thing about private equity folks is that tournament starts out very congenial and gentlemanly, and everybody's polite the first game. By the last game, people are bloody nosed, they're scraped, they're, you know, barely walking, because although there's no prize, you know how it is in that world.
So you would say you're the Bill Lambier of the transaction advisory industry?
There used to be a player for the 76er called Luke Jackson. I don't know if you remember. Ooh,
I don't. Was that like before the Billy that Collins
goes,
era?
That goes way back.
Yeah.
That's back in the short shorts era.
Exactly. Luke Jackson was my kind of player.
Luke Jackson would be in the tradition of like coming out of the 1950s, not like Tommy Heinsohn, but Jungle Jim Lustikoff.
One of the
bruisers who would be relevant when you were counting up the number of fouls that you had to throw against the other teams or highly skilled player.
The ratio of minutes played to fouls awarded was higher than most. But you guys, you have to remember, guys, I'm materially younger than you, and you guys are, you know, I'm just trying to play catch up and chime in as much as I can.
Charlie likes to give the impression that I am much older than he is. But it's not nearly as true as he likes to let on. And, you know, Jay and I, of course, are just about the same age. So rocket us through growing up in Philadelphia. In some ways, you've had a lot of career stability. In other ways, a place where you work has gone through a number of different incarnations. Why don't you give us that trajectory?
I've been fortunate, really blessed, to be at the same firm or iterations of it for 35 years. And I've been married for 35 years. Unlike Andy, who's been married probably for over 35 years, I've been married to the same woman. And Andy's had a couple of lovely women along the way.
Hey, you got to be careful there. Charlie,
Jay. Okay, you just got a gold star of all of our previous guests. That was well spoken. Well done.
That was said with a lot of affection for Andy, of course, because I have a lot of affection for Andy, but I have been fortunate. And I sort of kid with my children and say, I've never really had the same job for more than a year at our firm. And I kid with our CEO and said, you're still trying to find something I'm good at. So you keep changing my job. So I started out like everybody else as a junior accountant and worked my way up. And then I missed a meeting at our old firm, Philadelphia, and they made me managing partner while I was out of the room. And I was managing partner of that firm, about 150 person firm, 92-year-old firm when I became managing partner. It was Goldenberg Rosenthal. And within a couple of years, it became apparent that we needed to do an upstream merger. We needed more talent. We needed more capital. We needed more sort of ability to grow. And we had a great group of clients, some clients for 50 years, you know, some amazing clients, including Dick Clark and Dick Clark Enterprises. And, you know,
Charlie, do you know who Dick Clark?
I do.
Do you know who Dick Clark is?
I do, Andy. I mean, again, I read a lot. That was before my time, but I do know who he is, yes, or was.
So that was Goldenberg Rosenthal. We decided to do an upstream merger. We merged with Amber Palacina and Mattia. After that, I was asked to run our New Jersey practice, which was really, we combined a bunch of offices. We had 300 people at the time in New Jersey. So I got the great opportunity to bring, you know, a whole bunch of people together, which was just a boatload of fun. And we grew that by about 100 people in 6 or 7 years and by about $50 million in revenue. So that was a blast. And that was a defining sort of time in my life personally, because I was surrounded by such incredible talent. And I was the fortunate person to help them even grow some more. So I would walk around our office in New Jersey and just be in awe of the incredible talent and specialists that we had. Brought in a bunch of partners, brought in some firms along the way. And then after that, I was asked to be our firm-wide, vice chairman of growth. And I've been doing that now for, I guess, around 5 years. And along the way, we did bring in some private equity investment, which was a significant amount of private equity investment back in 2021.
So, Jay, it seems like you've been in kind of the same, at the same firm or an incarnation of the original firm for a long period of time. When was the last time you wrote a resume?
So my resume, I write a resume like once a month because as
things, no, you do.
And when we when we're talking to other firms, they want to know about us. But an external resume, like a real resume, is about 35 years ago.
So Jay, you've obviously migrated from managing clients to managing direct reports. People don't make that transition unless they're really, really good at managing clients, right? You've rose to a leadership role. Do you miss managing clients?
So I still manage some clients because for two reasons. Number one, I think it's important to understand what your partners are going through every day. And they also respect people who are still in the, quote, in the trenches. If you're just an administrator, I think you lose a touch and you lose a bit of the, respect of your colleagues. So I would just, as a level set, say, I think it's important to continue to work with clients. That's what all of us do. So in terms of my sort of view on working with clients, they want proactivity. They want you to be a business partner. They want you thinking about your business. And that has to be something that you're interested in and that comes a bit natural to you. You can teach it a bit, but you have to have a foundation where you're really interested in what's happening, and you're trying to help your clients achieve their goals. And if not, then you should be in a different business. Or you should be, we have lots of technical people who are amazing and who are less part of the strategy of their clients, but they're amazing at what they do. I think everybody in professional services has their own gift. And they should, it's my job as a leader of a professional service firm to find what each individual's gift is and to help them, flourish and to grow with that gift. People do what they like doing. So allow them to do what they like doing and help them be really, really good at it. So when we talk about business development, we tell people, do what you like. We're not going to tell you got to do this, you got to do that. If you like writing or if you like speaking or if you like going out, do what you like doing.
Yeah. And, you probably, when you woke up this morning, you didn't know that you were going to be bestowed the following award, which is the first guest on Middle Market Musings that comes from a leading accounting or advisory firm. So, number one, you have that going for you. But number two, let's unpack what you just said, because we all compete in a market that is increasingly efficient and competitive. So maybe you can share with us what makes Eisner Amper special and how do you find, from a competitive standpoint, what do you do that allows you to earn the confidence of not only your clients, but also your prospects alike?
Client service. We have one of the highest client service ratings in the industry. And we monitor it. We train our people on how to service clients. We have a whole client satisfaction team. It's not as easy as it sounds. You actually have to pay attention to it and be deliberate. So I think that does differentiate us. We also have exceptional people. We've been blessed to be profitable. And we always say that when you're profitable, you can bring in the best. So we'll bring in, people who don't have any books of business. who it might take a year or two to get them, you know, fully, you know, you know, fully engaged or utilized. And that's okay. We're willing to make those investments in the future.
Reacting to your comment about letting people do what they're good at and what interests them, at some point, there are individuals who just aren't productive enough, or their strength aren't on strategy enough. What have you learned about making the call on those situations?
Be compassionate. Somebody once told me, that one of our leaders, that if you ever are comfortable asking somebody to leave the firm, then you're in the wrong business. And quite honestly, we try to help people. If in a situation where we've tried different things together and it's just not working out, I would say almost all the time people know it, and people appreciate that you've tried, and we might find another home for them. I work real hard at that. If I have to ask somebody to leave, we'll try to find another home.
Do you find that you have a faster hook now than 15, 20 years ago, or did you come to this fairly early in your management career?
I think I've learned a little bit about how to assess whether it's going to work or not going to work, and to make sort of accommodations to try to get, you know, whether it's a coach or whether it's special attention and resources within the firm. So I think, Andy, to your question, the sort of timeline is less only because we make adjustments to try to accommodate people more quickly. And if that doesn't work, we come to the sort of conclusion together. Like I said, people are pretty smart. They generally know if it's not working because we give a lot of feedback. There's a lot of communication, and it should never come as a surprise to somebody that you're asking them to transition out.
Jay, I want to circle back to a word you used in one of your previous answers, and that was compassion for your employees, which is not, I think, a little bit not certainly in keeping with what I think about when I think about culture and this sense of partnership at accounting firms. So maybe we could just unpack that a little bit and talk about the culture that you have played a role in developing at Eisner Amper. How is it different from your peer group, and how relevant, if at all, has it been to your firm's success?
Yeah, it's been very relevant, Charlie. And we're viewed, I think, I hope, as a really good place to work. So over the years, we've attracted lots and lots and lots of lateral partners as a result of that. We're viewed as a stable place, who make good decisions, who pay people right and treat people right. So that reputation has been a big part of our growth. As I mentioned before, lateral partners can come with business sometimes, and sometimes they come with nothing, but other than really good talent. So we've built a big part of our growth has been through lateral partners joining us, and that's because of our reputation.
Jay, we've talked before in this podcast about the differences between what I call businesses where best idea wins and businesses where the boss's idea wins. And, you know, you're describing the first kind of culture, but at some point businesses need to be run. How do you balance those two values?
Innovation. In innovative culture, we view ourselves as having an innovative culture. And part of that is encouraging people to share their ideas. And our commitment to people is every idea will be considered and you'll get feedback on it. So that helps engender an innovative culture. In terms of making a decision, groups, we have a great board, which we could talk about later. We have a great executive committee, and we do collaborate a lot. But at the end of the day, somebody's got to be responsible and make a decision, and that person has to be accountable for it. That doesn't mean you get destroyed if it doesn't work. It just means somebody is accountable for each of the initiatives that we have. So, Andy, I hope that answers your question, but I have a personal feeling that and this may not be exactly, you know, popular, but I think, you know, groups don't make decisions, individuals do, and groups collaborate to come up with ideas. But at the end of the day, you know, somebody has to be accountable for decisions that you make. And I think that's part of a thread, you know, a fabric of our firm. There's accountability. And like I said, we make mistakes, of course, and it's okay. And when you make a mistake, you own up to it, and we move forward and we fix it together. And that's all good. When there's no accountability, it just sort of, I think things are less successful.
You're listening to Middle Market Musings, brought to you by Greenberg Variations Capital and New Heritage Capital, along with our media partner, Private Equity Professional Digest.
So, Jay, maybe now's a good time to pivot to the decision among you and your colleagues to raise outside capital that resulted in an investment from Tower Brook. Before we specifically talk about Tower Brook, share with us a little bit about the thought process behind wanting to raise outside capital, the pros and cons. Was it a hard decision? Obviously, your life is going to change pretty materially when you end up partnering with an equity group.
As a firm, we've had the thought around private equity investment for many, many years. And over the years, we had talked to several. One in particular we had gotten pretty close with, but for a bunch of external reasons that didn't move forward. So our partners were pretty sensitized to the benefits and the concepts around private equity. We had talked to them about it. So when we came to them, you know, with a proposal about taking on an investment from Tower Brook, they had been already, you know, thinking about this and asking questions for a number of years. And I think that was important. We didn't just come into a meeting one day and say, oh, you know, we're taking on this large investment. They had been asking questions and thinking about it for a long time. So fast forward, we were introduced to Tower Brook, and we spoke with them and negotiated with them and got to know them, most importantly, over a period of about a year. And then we brought the opportunity to our partners, and we did get a unanimous vote among our partners to move forward. And that's pretty incredible in my mind, only because we had a very diverse group. It was a little bit over 190 partners, young, older, middle, other careers, laterals, non-laterals, you know, homebred, all the, you know, home-groomed, all those things. So we worked hard to really make it attractive for everybody.
What was the impetus to attracting outside capital in the first place?
Two things. One, we wanted to accelerate our growth, and we were doing maybe one M&A combination a year. So we knew we needed, if we either were going to stay where we are or we were going to grow, because the size we were at was kind of at the fulcrum. So I would say that was number one. Number two, the ability to invest in certain things like, you know, IT. Our technology budget has about doubled since we took on, partnered up with Tower Brook. So when your partnership, and lastly is sort of the partnership model is one where you wait, you know, you turn 65, then you get paid out over 10 years, your retirement. And that model is difficult for us to compete with other industries where there's a quicker road to some type of monetization event. So we're competing for talent now outside of the accounting industry. We're competing with technology companies. We're competing with consulting companies. In order to really compete, we really felt we needed a different model.
When you were going through your process of choosing a partner, obviously you spoke to equity sponsors. Did you also talk to strategic investors as well?
Yeah, we did over many years, Charlie. We spoke with a number of firms about doing large combinations. None of them seemed to fit. But yeah, we were very pretty attuned and knowledgeable. We met with most of the larger firms over the years.
If a strategic buyer didn't make a lot of sense as to where you are now, you ended up doing a deal, and a lot of our listeners are either on the buy side or the sell side. So you end up doing a deal with a private equity firm. I assume that they came in and took control.
The strategic would have been a difficult road for us because our Eisner Amper brand, particularly in the financial services space, is internationally known. And we've built a global network called Eisner Amper Global. And it would have been difficult for us to be absorbed into another firm because of the brand and the how that brand has helped us grow.
You know, when your investor is looking to monetize their investment,
right,
there's going to be a decision that's right. going to be made as to whether or not you're going to do another private equity deal.
Yeah.
Or they might look to sell out to a strategic. And I'm just curious about how you and your partners think about that.
Yeah, they might acquire us through one of their future funds.
Sure.
Kind of thing. It could be any one of those. We are owned by a private equity fund, and there's a lot of good things that come with that. And exit at some point, we would view as being really great for our colleagues. So that they would have a liquidity event, and would be really great for our clients because we continue to be able to do what we're doing for them with even additional capital. So that day will come. Don't know exactly when, but that day will come where we will go through another transaction. So our partners have various equity. Some of it's in the form of stock, some of it's in the form of, we call it MIPS, but it's really a form of options. So I think our partners look forward to that day, unsure when that will be.
Jay, starting before TowerBrook came in, but obviously accelerating since, you and your partners have been extremely active in doing acquisitions. As you were recounting your career earlier, you've been through three changes in leadership where in each case you ended up part of the succeeding management structure. What did you learn along the way from being on that side of the table that affects how you look at the prospective business seller who you come across now?
Yeah, we look for a couple things. We think about what the future is going to be like with a firm that joins us, because the senior partners are important, but they're going to be there for a limited amount of time. We generally ask that all the partners be around for at least 3 years. You need 3 years to transition the responsibilities, to transition their clients. But it's really about the younger partners. That's the future. So when we talk to a firm, we're very focused on what's the next sort of generation of leaders within a firm. And will they be able to assume leadership positions within our firm? Because as we grow, we need more and more leaders and talented people. When we're talking to a firm, Andy, that's the first thing we look for, is younger
talent.
Do you make a
distinction between firms that are primarily accounting and firms that are primarily consulting or offering other fee-based services?
Yeah, we do. We do, because if our M&A strategy really is a couple of different, focused on a couple of different areas. There are some geographies that we'd like to fill in, and we do not want to be in every city in the country, but there are cities that we feel are key to our strategy. There's a couple of cities left, LA, Boston, the South, several cities. So that's number one, is filling out our geography. Number two, if a firm brings additional expertise that we don't have, we combined in a firm in Dallas a couple of years ago, and that came with exceptional oil and gas experience. So we now have an oil and gas practice. that's just one example. In addition, if it adds to experience that we have and one of our larger industry groups, that's also terrific. And lastly, I would say specific technical experience. So I'll put it this way. We have focused so far on adding accounting firms and adding clients. Many of them have broad advisory practices, including wealth management, including, you know, whether it be digital experience, but we focus mostly on the accounting firm part of it and some with the wealth management. So how do we look at those differently? Look, it depends. The valuation can be a little bit different for advisory, Andy, than it can be for accounting firms, depending on what the particular area is. There's a little more competition often with certain advisory specialties, which you know, could impact the price and impact our strategy. We're trying to build a professional service group that, that provides solutions for our clients. That's we really want to be a solution provider.
Is it usually pretty clear whether the advisory business should be integrated into your existing offering? Or, you know, you give the example of the oil and gas practice, which is a discrete area of expertise, left separate.
So I'll give you an example. We brought in a compensation consulting firm, standalone, in 2020. And that group had a strong name, also had a really strong reputation in the compensation consulting group. Now, they're part of our advisory group, but we've maintained them as a bit of a separate compensation resources and ISRAMPER, you know, an ISR advisory group firm. So it really depends, Andy, on sort of the nature of it. If there's a special brand and if there's a special expertise, we might keep that a little more separate than the other advisory firms we bring in. Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can start, I'm going to talk about the M&A efforts. Jay, since you did your deal with Towerbrook, I know there's been a big focus on M&A. Maybe you can share with us a bit about how that's unfolded.
Charlie, the accounting world is going through a transition. There's been several other firms who have done, have become private equity platform firms, and there will be more in the not too distant future. So there's a lot of every M&A deal that we look at has got competition, and we try to differentiate ourselves with our culture and with the way that we treat colleagues. That's important. We also have a strong capital partner behind us. The industry's changing. Whereas before we were one of the only platform firms, now there are more, and we're seeing them, you know, at the table with us, which is great. Also, CBIZ has been a public company in the accounting space for a long time. So we see them, they're a good competitor. And so I think the face of accounting is going to change. And over the next year, there'll be continued consolidation because there is capital in the industry.
How do you pencil out the pluses and the minuses of operating as a public company versus a private one?
For us, because we have a pretty big financial service practice, operating as a public entity would be more challenging. We represent, 500 private equity funds, over 1,000 hedge funds. And with some of the SEC rules around that, it would be challenging for us to really operate under a public company environment. We do have the alternative practice structure, where our audit firm is separate and has separate ownership. But at the end of the day, you're still subject to most of the independence rules, even with that.
So in looking at any business, and I say this as a banker primarily on the sell side, but from the buyer's perspective, you look at a business and it's like looking at a mug of beer that has a certain amount of foam on it. And as the buyer, part of your job is to visualize the settling of the foam. Looking at all of these accounting firms, what is typically the foam that you need to cut through?
Yeah, concentration, client concentration. I know that's typical for any industry. So if there are, a small number of clients that make up a significant amount, in most firms, that is the case. So we do some, we ask to actually meet those clients, you know, at least have a phone call with them. The second thing is really the quality of the next generation I mentioned earlier. So that's part of the phone. I would say the third thing is quality. We try to hold ourselves to a high standard of quality, and we've got all kinds of infrastructure around that. So the firms who are joining us may not have quite the same infrastructure, and we want to understand quickly whether there's going to be a significant quality adjustment.
Jay, when you think about M&A, and you've done these 10 acquisitions since you took on private equity from Tower Brook in 2021, is bigger always better?
Charlie, we talked a little bit, we've talked a little bit about, politicization of a firm. And I think it's our job as leaders to make sure that that does not occur and that we stay true to our roots. So getting bigger can be better as long as you stay true to who you are. And what I mean by that is people need to be recognized based on the quality of their work and based on the contributions they make to the firm and their clients. Mm-hmm. As long as that's a core value, that's a true core value. And getting bigger can, you can lose your way a little bit. We've worked really hard to stay true to that as a value. So it's not always better, but it certainly can be. And for us, it has been so far.
I have a general question. When you talk about the next generation, typically the sellers are, 60 years old plus or minus, and they're touting a generation coming up behind them. And the members of that generation are 45, 50. As a general matter, do you see differences between the founding generation and the successors who you're looking to for long-term management?
When you're dealing with a founder of a firm, that founder may have not taken payroll for a year. They may have put their house up as collateral. They've been through, I'll call it the wars, and they have the scars to show for it. So that's a little bit of a different mentality for somebody who has not yet seen going through the wars and seen it. On the other hand, our younger colleagues in the 40, 45 range, let's say, are much more technologically savvy. They have a little bit of a different view of life. The truth is there is a difference, and I think the biggest difference is sort of the wars that the older partners have really gone through and the experiences that they've had.
This has been a really fun conversation, but before we set you free, I did notice on your firm's website and on your bio page, and one specific question really kind of interested me, and the question was, what is the most played song on your iPod? So my first question is, what is an iPod and are they still in existence? And number two, your answer was any Todd Rundgren song. So
that's a little bit outdated now, because I think during the pandemic, Charlie, I really needed something inspiring. So I actually listened to Lovely Day by Bill Withers. Almost,
great song.
Almost every day, because it gets my day started, right?
So if you were at a concert, Grateful Dead concert, mid-70s, and somebody came up to you and offered to sell you something, would you say something like, you might want to look into capitalizing your marketing expense?
That's pretty funny. All right. I usually go laugh out loud at Andy questions. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it took a little
bit. We made up for our lack of smarts with good collegiality and friendship.
Jay, you have had a classy professional voyage. Hopefully we haven't brought it to a grinding halt. It's been great to have you on Middle Market Musings.
It's been a fun hour and a lot of fun, and a privilege to spend some time with both of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Middle Market Musing. We'd like to extend our sincere thanks to Jay Weinstein for joining us today, as well as our sponsors, New Heritage Capital and Greenberg Variations Capital, as well as our media partner, PE Professional Digest. Thanks as well to our editor, Jason Cipollo. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, we'd encourage you to like and follow Middle Market Musings on Spotify, Apple, or whichever provider you use to access your podcast. And of course, feel free to share with your friends. Thanks again, and we look forward to catching you on the next one.